I'm Steve Adams. My buddies up here forgot to put my at MS Device Guy. So if you Twitter me, at MS Device Guy. I am Steve Adams, Microsoft's The Device Guy. And I just wanted to take a few minutes and literally 2 minutes, and share sort of what's important to Microsoft, what we're thinking about when it comes to Windows 10 and deployment. So first of all, who in the room has an EA with Microsoft? Okay, excellent. And who knows that with an EA comes DDPS, or deployment services vouchers? Okay, so everyone that didn't raise your hand, you have vouchers that will help you deploy Windows 10 through our partners. So please, please, please go to your EA person and say, what are these vouchers I've heard of? These are not the vouchers you're looking for. Yes, they are. They're DDPS vouchers. Second of all, everyone that has, that all of our customers in the room, who works with a Microsoft partner to help them with deployment? Okay, excellent. We have funds available through our partners called Accelerate. Repeat after me, Accelerate. Okay, Microsoft has money to give you to help you deploy Windows 10.
I patched it.
Oh, excellent. Oh. So, thank you, Johan. I feel so loved now. Thank you very much. We're here all week. No, we're not. We're leaving this afternoon. So two buckets of money that we have for you that go underutilized every year. First one is DDPS vouchers. So go to your EA administrator and say, give me those vouchers. That allows you to bring in your partner of choice to help you proof of concept, pilot, or go into production. So please use those. Second one, what was the magic A word? Accelerate. Ask your partner. Ask your Microsoft field person. How do I get Accelerate funds to help accelerate my deployment? So what I just shared there is what's important to Microsoft this year with Windows 10. Yusuf on Monday shared with us that we were at how many million Windows 10 devices? Boy, I wish I had prizes for the front row here. 400 million devices. Okay, that's 40% of our target. We want how many devices? 1 billion Windows 10 devices in the first 14, 15 months of the product's existing. That's pretty amazing for a desktop operating system. How long did it take us to get to 400 million with Windows 8? We're still not there. So anyway, please, please, please use our resources, use our teams, use our money. We are here to help you deploy, and to help you deploy even better and troubleshoot those annoying little things. Johan and Michael, take it away.
Thank you, sir. Awesome.
Thank you.
Yes, this will be a deep dive, level 400 session on troubleshooting, mostly Config Manager, but lots of stuff we'll do here today is also very applicable to just standard light touch deployment. So just a curious question, how many of you are using Config Manager in this room? That's about everybody. You still, I assume at least most of you are also using LightTouch, not for production deployment, but also for building reference images. So we'll touch a little bit on that as well.
And we will also do demos, both in LightTouch and Configuration Manager. And the reason why we do a lot of demos in LightTouch is because it's faster. It is the exact same way it's going to work in Configuration Manager. It's just to shorten down the demo time. It's the same task sequence engine, basically, so there's
well,
no
standalone
difference.
Version, but yes. Yeah. So my name is Johan, this is Michael. We both work for TruSec, and we have some distinguished people also here on the heckler's row. We have Troy, Mike, and Michael Niehaus, probably going to ask you some hard questions, I think. There is a monitor or a Twitter feed as well that we monitor here on stage. So if you tag your questions with the session code, hashtag BRK3150, we'll be able to catch them. We also have people, Amy is offline and watching the stream, well, online remote, and watching the stream as well, and can answer questions. So give us questions there, as well as we would love to have questions on stage, or here in this room. Yes, shall we?
Absolutely.
You're the clicker.
I'm the clicker. So my work for the entire session is to do this.
Yes. and you do it so well.
Thank you so much.
As I mentioned, this is a troubleshooting session. This is a deep dive session. We assume that you have used this stuff before. So we'll use Notepad. So be in command prompts and PowerShell prompts. So we hope you're not be afraid of that. Next. So starting off, debugging config manager things. Everyone who's been doing any type of troubleshooting in config manager knows that it's the log files that you turn to. Since 2012, Microsoft kindly added in SceneTrace right into the boot image, so that's the premier utility. Unless your name is Wally, then you use another utility. But SceneTrace is the one that you use to read the log files. It's real-time, it's updated, it's formatting them well, and simple, it's good stuff.
How many times do you get the question, I have the following issue, yada, 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 and your reply is, can you send me the log files?
About every single time.
And then the other guy says, well, I don't have the log files. And in that case, the answer is, I can't help you.
Yeah. So the interesting thing about the log files is they are in different locations depending on when it fails. And I'll come back to that in a bit. Also, the default or the main log file in Config Manager is the SMSTS log file. And even though Microsoft, already back in R2 SP1, actually increased the size of it from 1 megabyte to 2 megabyte, it's still scenarios because of the default settings in Config Manager where debug logging actually is enabled for some reason, I don't know, but it is. It generates a lot of data, easily 5-6 megs of data. And if you think of the number 5 and 6 and you try to fit that amount of data into a 2 meg container, it's challenging.
Slightly?
Yeah, math. But anyway, I will talk a little bit more about that shortly. So next slide, please. So we do have other options available as well. Every now and then when you do things, the sequence will, start to do its actions. And every now and then it will report back to the site server, send up status messages, not super detailed, but sometimes good enough to help you troubleshoot. And you can view that information in reports. There are a bunch of progress reports in Config Manager. There is also you can create queries directly through those status messages inside the console. So you can get the information there too. Of course, you can also enable server-side logging. That's available both for MDT and Config Manager, LightTouch and Config Manager. And when you do that, if something fails, well, the log files will be copied to the server. And not only the SMSTS log file, everything else as well. The logic of the script that does this is actually smart enough to reach into your machine and grab every possible log file it can think of to help you debug. So for example, if the sequence passed the step that does driver injection, you will actually see the log file, DISM log file, that can help you debug drivers on the server in the folder where that computer name is. There will be a net setup log file that can help you debug join domain operations, assuming it actually came to that point in the sequence. So it grabs some 20 files from your machines and put them in a folder on the server so you can easily debug those. Next slide, please.
How do you turn that on?
How do I turn that on? I will absolutely show you how to turn that on in a bit. Good question. The second thing is, well, the log files will only be there assuming we can actually start the deployment. And it happens every now and then that you have a machine, you press F12 or you press Enter if it's a UEFI machine to pixiboot it and it doesn't pixiboot. It will just give you like a abort pixie and it dies immediately. So that point, the log file on the client doesn't really help because we don't have any at that point. We are still just dead in the water. The machine is basically, nothing is running on that box. So slide. So.
Says demo. And your number?
7.
7.
Very nice. So I'm going to start a non-Pixie deployment first for a reason. I'm going to start a light touch deployment. So I will go to a clean VM that is configured to boot from an ISO. Should start pretty quickly. The reason I'm using Light Touch is because they are special. When you start a Light Touch boot image, it actually kicks off a small wizard that drives you through the deployment. You can automate that fully, of course, but what is it in the boot image that actually starts this? Why is this happening? Because if you go into ADK and you create yourself a custom boot image and you boot it in a VM or a physical box, I promise you it will do nothing. It will give you a command prompt and it's black and it will do nothing. So why is that this guy actually did something, in this case presented a list of sequences to me? Bootstrap, yes, but that's later. If I open up the command prompt and adjust the font size a little bit and the colors a little bit. In the root of that boot image, there is an unattend file. If I open that unattend file, you can see it's actually setting the screen resolution, which works great in BIOS-based machines, not so great on UEFI-based machines. You can see it's actually launching a script. That's why it starts the wizard. This script, yes, reads the bootstrap in the file and tries to figure out what to do. But this is why the boot image actually does something at all. And this is useful for Config Manager. In a few customer environments already, both for 15.11, both for 16.02, and both for 16.06 versions of Config Manager, I have seen an interesting error happening. So this is my blog. This is the error you might see. It complains about not finding a network adapter. And you press F8, you do an IP config, and there is a network adapter. And you can see it just, you get this immediately. It's not like it's even trying to find a network adapter. So this is obviously a bug. But the fix is so easy. Create an unattend file, put it in the boot image, in the root of the boot image, and it will actually run even before the pre-start command in Config Manager, which is needed to work around this issue with networks. I have seen this twice on conference networks too, because they often are less maintained than a normal corporate network. So I wrote a script that I'm very proud of, a lot of work. Thank you.
Do you have a training on that?
Yes, I do. But simply, I gave it more time to do its business. And that solved the problem for all those networks, every single one of them. So if you do run into that issue, remember that, yes, you can put an unattend file in the root. You can have that to call a script to do something. I've seen other customers doing this to actually clean up disk. They may have been using, say, a third-party disk encryption on the box, and then they want to go BitLocker, so they will try a bare metal deployment, and the config manager action will try to start to do its business of formatting drives, and sometimes it gets upset if there is third-party disk encryption on the box. But if you clean it first, problem goes away. So that's why I'm way you're doing it. And let me just double check these guys. So we assume we boot, we will get the log files. So I will stop this VM. And I will pause my MDT server because I'm going to do a pixie boot. And my MDT server is also a pixie server. And I don't know if you try, but having multiple pixie servers on the same subnet at the same time is interesting because they will fight. So I will take a normal VM, a generation 2 VM, and I will pixie boot this guy. Press enter, it will start to download the boot image. And what can you do to speed up that process? Well, this morning, I stumbled across this blog post. Mr. Jörgen Nilsson, fellow Swede. This is new in Config Manager 16.06. that will help you, even in other virtualization platforms than Hyper-V, to get the speed when you Pixaboot and download boot images that way. Because this one up here has been around for a long, long time. But this one is new and can actually help mitigate some of those long downtimes of downloading boot images. This varies with hardware. I've been very successful by setting this to 8 in most environments, except for ProBooks. But it's often, you can often increase it to something higher than that. So anyway, the machine Pixabooted, and I can start to log in. Now, when I press Enter here after typing in the password, it's going to contact the site server, and it's going to look for policies, deployments for this machine. If you are on slow networks, really high latency networks, this may time out on you, and you will get an error message saying, sorry, no policies for you. But first of all, it could actually be that you don't have a deployment. So how do you troubleshoot that part? How do you know already at the Pixaboot if the machine will have a deployment or not? SMS Pixelog, thank you, sir. So if I go to my site server, go into my installation directory of Config Manager, wherever you have it. Please don't have it on the C drive. The inboxes are in that folder, and they can be full if something goes wrong. And then it's bad if it's on the C drive. So I open the Pixelog file, and you can actually see here in pretty much clear text that, okay, I have MAC address here. It tried to boot. That machine found an optional advertisement. It was this sequence or this advertisement for that, sorry, deployment. I don't know what they call it, advertisement still. But it actually found a boot image eventually, and it handed that boot image down to the client. But this is how you can see what's actually going on the server side. Now, what to do if it takes too long? Well, there are variables you can set to give it more time. And obviously, you can't set those variables in the sequence because we haven't yet started the sequence. The problem we are having is we don't see any sequences. So, let me see variables here. Ah, wrong one. These guys. That's the script. There it is. Here we go. I don't need to sum those guys. So, these are the variables. I simply have a VB script that sets them. Easy. And I call the script through the normal pre-start command in Config Manager. Again, giving it more time. This one you will not like to call from an NN10 file. The reason is you need to call it from the pre-start command, otherwise you don't have the environment up and running. But again, this is easy. I have them documented as well on my blog, but this is something you can do to give it more time at deployment. But I will select the sequence and I will continue. It will start to format the disk once to stage a packet, and then it will continue and do its business. In this case, it's actually gone on a pause for a little after a while. And this is something that is really useful when debugging things. In my sequence, on the site server here, let me pick that one. If I edit that, you will see that here I added a pause. I added it directly after it tried to format the disk the first times. So in this scenario, I was troubleshooting disk partitioning. Something happened. I added a pause to the sequence, so it actually aborted at that point. And at that time, I can now just open a command prompt. Press F8, run disk part. Try to partition the disk manually. Verify that I actually have a driver for it. And not only just clean it and create a partition, but actually format the partition as well. Because sometimes you can create a partition, but it's the format action that will fail. And when you run that interactively, well, sometimes you will see things that you don't do when you just have the sequence engine running. And at that point, I mean, if you place a support call with Microsoft, it doesn't really matter what deployment solution you're using. You can just tell them flat out, I'm starting on a Windows PE boot image. I cannot run disk part and create the partition. And that will be much easier for them to help you troubleshoot that process also through support. But anyway, if I go back to my client, it should now have reached the point where it's pausing. And the very, this was actually slightly harder to code this script because it was 7 lines of code. So I put that script in my MDT package, and that's something I recommend to do. Every custom script that you guys use in your sequences, put them in the MDT package. Why? Because it's always there. They always stage that packet on disk. You always have those files available to you. That's why you see in the sequence many, many, many times, there is a use toolkit package option. This is where they make sure that those files are available to you. So if I go into the scripts folder here, CDI, pause, winp, this is it. This is just a script that is looking for a text file. And as long as that text file doesn't exist, it will just wait. Loop and wait.
Now, so here's a good question for you. That assuming that you integrate MDT with Configuration Manager.
Yes.
Yes. There's always someone that says, I don't want to do that.
Yes.
Yeah. Because we don't need that extra functionality. But we don't really have that approach. It's not the functionality. We want to have a deployment framework. And a good starting point is to have that toolkit. So even if you are using a native Configuration Manager sequences, you can still include this package just to have all the scripts available.
I mean, you can view MDT as a bag of, you know, candy or stuff that you really, really like. You pick the stuff that you like the most, and you use that. Just because that package contains some 200-plus features for OS deployment, you don't have to use all of them. And I know very few customers who uses all of them. But you pick the stuff you like. And the framework for development is just one of them.
Yes.
So anyway, I will press F8. I will get a command prompt. I will do the same operation here again to make it slightly more visible. At this point, I can open CMTrace. Obviously, I can go to the default log location in the beginning, which is the Windows temp folder on the X drive. And I can open the sequence log engine. And I can follow my deployment from here. If I want to, I can also go into my C drive in this case. It doesn't have to be the C drive. It could be E, F, something. Because drive letters in Windows PE are temporary. It's not the same as Windows will actually be installed to eventually. But in here, I will have a WD package folder. I will also have the normal packages folder to which the sequence downloads all its packages eventually. But this one is special. This one is the MDT package. So here I can go to the scripts folder. And I can run, for example, a script that will enumerate all the settings that I have currently in my sequence and just dump them out to the screen, or preferably, how about pipe this to a text file and open that text file in Notepad. Because now I can start to drill down and see all my variables. You can see that I have, in this sequence, done something I highly recommend. I have added a variable to increase the timeout. So if I go to my sequence and check at the beginning of it, I have added this one. To change the default timeout from 15 minutes into 24 hours. So if something breaks, I will actually know about it. So I don't miss it accidentally just because I left the room when I started the deployment. I've also added in another one that you can see on that list, and that's this one, reboot when done. This, I would say, is critical for most config manager environments. And I can see that on the client. I do have an SMSTs post action. This is something that happens when the sequence is done. And I use this to force a group policy refresh, because the normal config manager sequence will suppress all group policy processing when it's running. But sometimes you do want to apply policies when you're done with it. And forcing a reboot is, well, will refresh the policy. Other things you can work on is, of course, following this information or doing this from the server side. Check this stuff or most of this stuff. So you do have the server-side logging I mentioned. And this is really tricky to enable. That was a question before, how do I enable this? Well, you go into your settings package that you have in your sequence, and you simply add a one-liner. This is one of the 200-plus features that MDT gives you, server-side logging for Config Manager. So when you enable this, if something goes wrong, it will create a subfolder for each computer that you deploy and copy all the log files through that folder, so you can easily debug it. Very, very handy. Now, another thing you can do with this is also, of course, check it through the reports. So I will cancel this sequence. I will go back to my monitoring node. Thank you. I will go to my deployments. Progress of a running sequence deployment. I will run that report. You can also use the browser to run the report. I will select my deployment. It was my debug sequence. Thank you. And I can now see that so far, it's actually been doing some stuff here. You can start to track to see what the sequence did and when it did it. So you have some information about what's going on somewhat real time. It's still not every step, but you know, all the actions in the sequence at least is being reported back this way. Back in CMOS 7, I really liked the way it was by default, because in CMOS 7, there was ready-made status message node to find deployment info, and they kind of removed that from Config Manager, which made me sad. But it's not that hard to create your own ones. So here I've created a query, which if you look at the code here, it's a bit messy, but it's coming. I'm basically looking for status messages that belongs to my deployment. And if you search for this out there, you'll find plenty of examples of this. But now I can run that query. Can specify for how long back, a day or two. And you wait patiently, as you do. But here you see I have a status message from that computer. And when you start to look into the details, you will actually see additional information about everything that was happening here. And sometimes that can give you some clues as well to debug things. The nice thing, this is server-side. You don't have to be on that client, which can be in another state in a different country. So this is useful as well. What you also can do in Config Manager is there are filter rules that you can enable. So if you go to your site, you have your status filter rules. And you can create your own ones. What was the happiness? What's the code for happiness? Could be 42, yes, but in this case it is 1111171. And if it's happiness, you can launch a program that sends you an email with a green logo on it and say, yay. You can also do the opposite, which is probably more interesting. You can search for non-happiness, utterly failure, which is this error code or status matches, and you can do something else. And now the site server is keeping track of your deployments and sends you an email when stuff is good and when stuff is bad. Or it creates a ticket in help desk, do something. But this is also quite powerful to do in Config Manager. So one final thing, though. That log file I mentioned, the size of it. I spent an afternoon, a Friday afternoon, deploying Windows, as you do, on Friday evenings. Probably had a beer in my hand. And I ran through deployments with every single combination of log settings there was in Config Manager just to see what difference it would be on the log file. And then I compared the log files. And it turned out that in Config Manager, by default, since debug logging is actually enabled, you get more content, I mentioned this before, than you have in your log file size. So again, 2 meg. And one archive makes 4 meg. It's still less than 5 or 6. So you have two options. Either you simply increase the size, in this case to 16 megs. And I only do this right now in the Windows PE part, because in deployment, that's actually where most errors happen. I can do it for Windows also by changing the properties of the Config Manager agent in the sequence, but this is often all I need. And since I have it to 16 megs, I don't really need to have much of a history of it. I rather have everything in one file than two files. Because if I do 10 deployments, and it creates two log files from those 10 deployments, I would open the wrong one 10 times in a row. You never pick the right one. It's simply as Murphy's Law. What you also can do is simply disable debugging. I'm not sure why it's on by default. My theory is that a developer enabled it 8 years ago. And it's been stuck since. But that's just a theory, not confirmed with the product team. But the thing is, here are two log files. One that has debugging enabled. The other one have it disabled. And what I found so far, this often gives me enough to debug things. And when you do that, the log files are indeed only 1 to 2 megs and actually works with the default setting. So shorthand story, to get this going, you create an ini file. You make sure it's in the boot image. And in the later releases of Config Manager, you can simply place this log file on the site server and it will be added to the boot image. Previous versions, you had to add it to your boot image yourself, which was very easy. You can update your OSD injection file. You can simply copy it to the Windows folder on the boot image. You do that once and you're happy. So this is how you can make sure this stuff is easy to debug and easy to work with. Now, back to slides.
Slides. I can do slides.
Yes.
So we talk about drivers then, right?
Yes.
So drivers is still the part of operating system deployment that I find very
fun.
Yeah. Because it's always this battle between me and the machine. I usually wins. Otherwise, you can always throw away the machine and say, hey, it doesn't work. But we have different drivers. And the first driver we really need to make sure it works is the Windows PE driver, right? I can see customers saying, hey, there's new drivers for Windows PE. Should I download them and install them? No, you shouldn't. But there are new, yeah, but you shouldn't, unless you need to. So the question is, when do you really need to have a driver? Well, we're going to cover that. Then we have the setup phase. And sometimes we are into a small, slightly challenging issue, is that you injected the right driver, it's just Windows picks another one, and you go like, hey, I didn't tell you to do that. And then you try it again, it's like, hey, it's still picking the wrong one. I'm going to cover that. And then we have drivers that can't be installed as drivers. I mean, they're always going to be, you can get it to be kind of installed. So there's a driver, but when you try to use the function or the application, it doesn't work. Eventually, you're going to figure out the following. needs to be installed as an application. There's no way around this. And that's fine. I do understand that sometimes you need to do that. You want to click?
No.
You're not certified. I'm going to do it again. It says demo.
Yes. I'm so impressed.
You're number 7, so I guess I'm number 8.
Or 6.
No, this is from yesterday.
Okay.
I can remove that. No, it doesn't need to be updated.
Neither your help, though.
Yeah, it usually does. So, number 1, how do you verify that you have a driver that actually works in Windows PE? Well, you boot it up in Windows PE, and then you type, this is very advanced, ipconfig.
Yeah, level 500.
Yeah. So, and if you get an IP address, you don't need a network driver. It's very simple. You have one that works. But then you need to verify that you have access to the disk subsystem. So disk part it is. And disk needs
to spell it also.
I know, it doesn't have the automatic spelling thing for me. In disk part, you do disk. And hey, I have a drive. So that I'm fine. No, you're not fine. Because this is very good as a starting point. But you really need to do this. Select disk. So, clean. Create partition primary. Assign. Active.
And format.
Format. FS.
You really don't need to do the assign and active. Michael is just doing that to show off right now. But this one you do need.
You need to format the drive, because we've been to that, it can't really see the drive, but when it comes to the action of creating the partition and formatting, it fails. So this is now verified. I don't need drivers. Okay. The easy part is usually to find the disk subsystem driver, because in most cases, if it's a client workstation, it's going to be either built in or it's going to be the generic SATA drives. But when it comes to network, it's slightly more challenging. What we can see people do sometimes, I don't recommend it, is to find every piece of network driver you have and cram it into your boot image, wait for a long time, and then hope it's going to work.
Record so far is about a gig. Mm. I've seen at one site of a boot image.
The hoping thing doesn't really fly for me. So I prefer to do it this way. Let's assume I don't have an IP address, but I expect these following drivers to be the right one. Put them on a USB stick, right? Or floppy? Anybody seen a floppy? And then you use an application called DRV load. And then you specify
the driver.
The driver. And I've cheated. I put it on my boot image. And you point to the INF file and you load the driver. And then you need to reboot?
Nope.
No, you don't need to reboot. You run WPE init to kick it off again. And now you can do the same thing. ipconfig, did I get an IP address? And you do this until you find a driver that works. Then you use that driver. It's very important that you are minimalistic when it comes to driver in Windows PE, because when you add a driver, you might lose support for another piece of hardware that you use in your organization, because it has been updated and been replaced and it doesn't work with older hardware. So even if it's possible to download an entire CAB file with Windows PE drivers, don't do that. Pick the exact driver you want to have. I know it takes some time, but usually it takes me in half an hour to figure out what driver I need for Windows PE. Now, that was Windows PE.
Yes. Then we have drivers for Windows.
Then we have drivers for Windows. We can go to the device manager, and we can see that, hey, I have a display driver here. It's an NVIDIA card. and that's pretty nice. And in this case, it did pick the right driver. Now, the problem with picking the right driver is that, I wouldn't say problem, the challenging is that Microsoft is using plug and play, sometimes called them plug and pray, but that's another story. It's based on ranking. So it's gonna grab all the drivers that you downloaded to the machine and say, hey, here's all the drivers, stage them. Absolutely, and then Windows will fire up and gonna say, hey, I'm gonna pick one of these. How many of you have kids? Multiple kids. There's one thing as a parent you do once when you have multiple kids, is that's going to the kids and ask them what they would like to have for dinner. Because if you have multiple kids, you're going to get multiple answers. Eventually, as a parent, you learn the fact that it's much easier that you pick the food, and then you'd say, dinner is served.
It will be meatballs.
Yeah, and then one of the kids says, I don't want to have that. Well, that's the only thing you're going to get, and they will eventually accept the fact and have the meatballs. And you need to treat Windows the same way. You need to feed Windows with the one and only driver, and Windows is going to be happy and say, hey, I found one. I want to use that.
It's the best.
It's the best of every one I used to pick. Now, the ranking system has been around forever. But you can search for why did Windows 7 pick that driver. And then you're going to find a blog post that explains that. And if you zoom in here, this is a part of the setup api.dev.log. You can see here, it actually did find two drivers. Here's
one,
and here's the other one, and of course, pick that one.
Because it's the best. It
from
says
a ranking point of view.
Selecting best.
Yeah, so, exactly. And the reason why it picks that is because it's best, because it has the best ranking. Now, ranking is divided in multiple numbers. The first two characters stands for signature code. That means that an unsigned driver will never, ever be picked. There's no way. It's unsigned. It's going to lose.
I mean, Windows 10 in general does not like unsigned drivers. So.
And sometimes you really need to have an unsigned driver because that's the only option you have. That is the correct driver. You're going to turn to the vendor. You're going to say, hey, I need a signed driver. And they're going to go like, huh? So then you need to co-sign driver, and that was used to be very simple because you can create basically a self-signed certificate. That doesn't fly anymore, so you need to have a real certificate, but you can't do co-signing of drivers. But you should go to the vendor and say, hey, I really need this driver to be signed. If you can't go to the vendor and get help, go to Microsoft and tell them to go to the vendor. They are slightly bigger than you, most of you anyway. And they have really good lawyers, so they can help you in that way.
I think the engineers is the right word, developers.
Yeah, but when you really want something done, lawyers actually works better.
Taking notes.
The next one stands for feature score, and this is how, for instance, Intel drivers are picked instead of the inbox drivers. It's the same driver, it has the same ranking, it has the same feature. Well, that's the trick. They're going to say that the out-of-box driver that you download has a slightly better feature score. It doesn't mean it has better features. It's going to be the more or less the same driver, but that's the way you're going to pick that. And that is how you can make a third-party driver being picked instead of the inbox driver by having it signed, and you bump up the feature score. Now it's going to pick that driver instead because it seems to be better, right? It's cheating. And the last four characters are identifier score, and that's how close they match. And if you go in here to my device, manager and do properties, and do details, and hardware IDs, here is the identifier score. So if I have the top one, It's going to be very close to my hardware, and it's going to pick that one. It even includes the revision of the physical hardware in my graphic adapter. If it can't find the A1 revision, well, it's going to take the slightly more generic, which means I don't care about the revision of the hardware, but it's going to be that device. Otherwise, it's going to pick something else. And the last one here is just very generic driver from NVIDIA. So it's going to work, it's going to have bad performance, and you're not going to have all the features. And that is how you make sure all these drivers work. Now, so once in a while, you need to have this drivers as application thing, right? So I'm going to use, this is just an example, right? You can do this for Dell, you can do this for Lenovo, for Jitsi, whatever vendor it is. It doesn't matter.
They have their own tools.
They have their own tools, and it's pretty easy to find that. Let's assume that for any reason I need to install the HP hotkeys support thing, because my users really want that feature. Anybody had a request for things like that? Yeah. And you go like, what do you, why?
I really need that. Okay, you need that, fine.
So I want to use the Vue softpack CVA, which is a text file. I'm going to open it up. And somewhere here, it says how to install this, hopefully. There it is. The obvious command, which is very simple.
Look at the stuff in the middle there, the log file.
Yeah.
Often with driver application, that's the key to have config manager be happy about that setup. For example, some of the older install shield setups that installs driver apps, if you don't have a log file, it will fail. But what you find in HP is they often provide you with the config manager switches in their information file about the driver.
And if I don't want to have it in the percent temp folder, right, I don't want to have it there, where should I put it? Well, I can use the parameters for where either LightTouch or Configuration Manager stores the log files and put the log file in the same location, which means if I now run SL share, those files will be copied as well, which is pretty nice. So I have the command line switch. I need to export this application. Copy softpack to directory. I'm going to put it on the desktop, create a folder, demo this. Okay. Hey, there it is. And we need to extract it. Maybe I can extract it this way. I don't want to install it. Yeah, I can extract it to that folder. That would be fun. Yeah, I don't need to install that. But I do need to grab the package, which is in the folder. And so here's the setup. Here's the entire application. 90. And go 90, copy. And then I need to create a package of that. I'm going to create a package in either Configuration Manager or create an application in LightTouch. It doesn't matter in what way. It depends on the deployment solution you have. How do you get that package installed based on the fact that it happens to be that particular kind of hardware? Because I don't want to create a task sequence thing and say, hey, if that happens to be that make and model, then you should install this application. We prefer to do it another way. And what we do is this, usually. I wouldn't say usually we do it every time.
Well, with one exception. What Michael is about to show you is the ability to have a separate engine feeding apps into the config manager sequence, which is fantastic for any type of network deployments.
Yeah.
So this is dynamic assignment or applications. This works awesome unless you're using a standalone boot media, where you actually need to have everything staged on the boot image.
Correct. In that case, you really, really
need to have it in the sequence.
Yes. Otherwise, we try to avoid that. So I can either use the model alias or make alias, VB script, or I can use just model. The only thing I do is that I specify that if it happens to be that particular model, then you should absolutely install the following application, and that is for LightTouch. Most of you are running configuration managers. You're not going to do mandatory applications 001. You're going to do packages.
Or applications.
Or applications. Packages 001 and equals to PS1 colon.
No, no, the package ID, sir. That's more than just PS1. I promise you.
PS1 colon?
No.
Something like that.
How many series did you add?
It doesn't matter.
Yes, it does matter.
It does matter. Do you want to count them?
Yes.
Oh, thank you. Now that's going to work. Install the HP.
So package ID and program name if you do legacy packages.
Or applications 001 and equals to the HP stuff for OSD. Usually, you don't need to, but a lot of customers are figuring out that sometimes it's easier to have a separate application in Configuration Manager just for the use of operating system deployment.
The thing is, we can only specify the application name here. We cannot specify the deployment type. And sometimes we're using the app model, you have more than one deployment type. If you don't, you don't need multiple apps, but if you do, well, you need to have multiple apps.
Exactly. But in this case, the likeliness of you having multiple application types or installer types for this application is very slim.
Yes.
But maybe you don't want to publish it. So there's a way around this. If you don't want to do it this way, well, then you open your task sequence and you specify the condition for that model alias make or whatever it is and say, hey, install this application based on this fact that it happens to be this machine. And there are a lot of things that needs to be installed like this. So when you do verify that every driver is working, it's not enough to just check the device manager. You really need to verify that whatever functionality that is behind that driver really works. Just because there's a device driver that says, hey, shiny, that's not going to be good enough.
All right.
Questions?
Slides.
Slides. Oh, that's five.
So, software updates. In Config Manager, this has been one of the, well, pain points for many, many years, to have the sequence install as many updates as possible in a single run. Now, with Windows 10, we don't really have that problem anymore. Because how many updates do we need to actually install? Typically, just one. I've seen some scenarios where there is a servicing stack update or a servicing stack update also, but in general, you need only one because they are cumulative. We actually have Carlos in the room here, sitting on that row over there. He owns Windows updates or software updates. So if you have a software updates question, I'm sure he will be happy to answer them. Anyway, when we build our reference images, in the current release of Windows 10, for the software updates action to work reasonably well in light touch deployments, what you need to do is to make sure that the latest CU, cumulative update, is actually added early on into the image. Because that it changes to the Windows Update agent that you really, really, really want. So how do you do that in LightTouch? Really? No, you're not allowed to. No. Anyone? You put them into packages. So I have a folder here for each version of Windows 10. Well, sorry about that. Number 7.
Bend your knees.
Happy?
I'm happy.
Good. So I have a folder for each Windows release I'm using it to build reference images of. So I've actually added in, this is the September 23rd, it's a week old update. So I simply add that, right click, and import it. I download it from the Microsoft Update site, the catalog site, and I just import it here. And then I'm creating a filter. So I have a selection profile that is also named, well, somewhat the same, where I have selected that folder. So I have a folder in packages where I import the update. I have a filter that selects that folder. And then in my sequence that actually builds and captures my Windows 10 machine, including a bunch of updates or components, there is an apply patches step. This one I have configured to use that selection profile.
Now, here's a good question, because someone in the audience are right now thinking, why do I need to create selection profile? Can't I just add all the drivers to the same file? I think I do that, and it works. It does. It does work if you add all the packages for every operating system into one big pile of packages. It is going to work.
Thing is, it's going to try to install them all. Windows 7, server, this version, and this version. It will take a pretty long time. And even though it will realize that, sorry, that wasn't for me, and it will continue, just don't do that. Just create that folder, create that filter, and your deployment will be happy.
Exactly.
So now the latest Windows Update agent is in the image. Most of the problems that were with it was solved in the last week's release of the update agent. So just make sure it's there. And that means you have a fairly up-to-date image. And if all the videos from Ignite are being published right now on YouTube, on the Ignite channel, and also will be eventually, I assume, available on Channel 9, at least they have been the previous years. But they are available right now on YouTube. And we did a session on Tuesday about mastering Windows 10 deployment expert level. And in there, we show you how to set up an image factory. And that's something we recommend that you do. But the shorthand story is, when me and Michael create reference images, this is typically what we do. Change the font size. We go to a folder where we have a script. And we run a PowerShell script. That's it. That script will take your deployment share and build a WIM file for each sequence that you have and store them on the site server. Fully automated, using MDT in the back end, but there are no excuses for not updating your reference images every now and then. You don't have to do it every week. Of course, there is no updates every week, but you know, once a month, every second month, something like that, because that really helps Config Manager later on, especially for Windows 7. There still are so many updates in Windows 7 that the default action here, let me take my Windows 7 one. This guy may time out. But it doesn't do that if your reference image is fairly up to date. So the quick fix, I say, is to make sure the reference image is up to date. Now, they did add a variable in, oh, help me out, 1606, that will allow you to specify the timeout to more than 30 minutes. Do you really want to have the sequence wait for more than 30 minutes? No. Get your image up to date, and you get away from the problem altogether. So yeah, that was some tips and tricks around software updates there. So. Slides.
Now again?
Yes.
It's too many slides. Like that.
No, we don't have too many slides. We have one and then we have demo. It's perfect balance.
Okay. It says demo. I'm going to skip that. So we then have the in-place upgrade limitations. I wouldn't say limitations, but we do have challenges around in-place upgrade. And number one, when we talk about in-place upgrades, yes, they work. Yes. We don't really have too many problems around it. One really common discussion at customer sites is this. We are planning to do an in-place upgrade, but we want to do a shifting from BIOS to UEFI, or we want to do this and we want to do this. If your machines are old and are going to be up for hardware replacement, doing an in-place upgrade, keeping the BIOS and everything, that's going to be fine. Because then you can have the users trying out Windows 10 before they need to replace the hardware. We don't need those Big Bang projects. Big Bang is a really nice TV series, right? But you don't need to spend too much. So challenges are, and you can go to this
your screen.
My screen. Oh, it says demo, almost. Now it says demo.
Yes, I see it.
I'm 8. So a friend of mine write this. We do have limitations. Language is one. I did have customers that deployed the UK version of Windows 8.1, and now they want to upgrade to Windows 10, and they want to also change to US English. It's not fun to be in those meetings, but yes. No, you can't.
That's one problem.
Sorry?
You can refresh it.
You can refresh it. That's another story, but true. Third-party antivirus, depending on vendor, even if you do have a supported antivirus, most likely you first need to upgrade it. Yeah, okay, so that's another story. You can't do 32-64, you can't do lower SKUs, but you can go from enterprise to education.
Proto-education.
Sorry?
Proto-education.
Proto-education, and then you can change that later on. You can't do boot from VHD, you can't do Windows to go, USB sticks, and that's fine, nobody's gonna do that anyway. That is basically the limitations we have. Other than that, nah, it flies really nice.
There was a note in the middle there that I was new in 16.07 for Windows,
yeah.
Which may give you some additional options in terms of third-party disk encryption, where you actually can have Windows install additional drivers for those scenarios. So if you have a vendor that has been working with this, your chances are higher than ever before.
Now, there's actually two kinds of in-place upgrades. One is going from Windows 10 or a previous operating system version to Windows, from Windows 7 to Windows 10. The other in-place upgrade scenario is Windows 10 to Windows 10, right? And that is going to be a more common scenario the more time we spend time on this. So I think it is the way to do a correct in-place upgrade.
Yes.
Now, if we do that, one of the things that you should be aware of, is this. Let's check this sequence. It pretty much looked the same way in Config Manager also, so we don't have a huge difference. I like to do it task sequence ways. There are the
servicing.
Servicing, but servicing is, we can't really control it in the way we want to, so I prefer to have a task sequence. That way you can determine when, how, and since it's a task sequence, what do you need to do before? Well, we can run the upgrade validation and say if it fails, then don't even try to do this. We can also update drivers, we can uninstall applications, we can install other applications after we're done. So using a task sequence for the in-place upgrade seems to be a better choice currently, and I strongly recommend you to do that.
Yes. So, other things? Let's see. Yeah. Even though Microsoft did add in the Reflect driver switch to the command line action, how do you get Config Manager to use it? Well, there is a really long variable that you can use as well to force additional command line switches into the step in the sequence that actually runs the upgrade. And that's all well if the driver actually works. So far in my experience, when you have third-party disk encryption on boxes and you want to do an in-place upgrade, or even sometimes you want to refresh them, it can be a really painful process to work with the vendor and get the drivers working and all that. A more sort of a bulletproof scenario is to actually treat it as a replace. So if I can have the screen.
Oh, absolutely.
Lucky number seven.
Lucky number seven.
So here I have a backup only sequence. This is the default replace sequence in Config Manager. It does a backup only. In here, you can also add additional BIOS configuration things if you want to convert from BIOS to UEFI. And Mike Terrell had a session yesterday, was it? Wednesday? Search for Mike Terrell on the YouTube channel, and you'll find a session entirely focused on how to do BIOS to UEFI things. And Michael also has some info there later. But this is a backup-only sequence. So I will run that on the existing box while it's online, because then I don't have any problem with reaching the info on it because it's online. And I will store the backup on a server somewhere. Then I simply take a normal bare metal deployment sequence, and in the end of that process, I restore that backup on the same box. normally replaces when you're replacing computers, but you can also do it on the same box to work around issues with third-party disk encryption. And that always works. So, slides.
Oh, slides. I'm shifting.
Yes.
So, let's talk about running PowerShell for a while.
In the sequence.
In the sequence. There are different ways. One is to use the built-in actions. They work. And then we can use, of course, custom actions, which means that we basically run it as a PowerShell script. We have variables and handlings, and we're going to cover that if I shift to 8. Now, one thing to remember is to make sure that you do have your Windows PE features set to include PowerShell.
Sure, this will add 100 meg or so to your boot image. I couldn't care less. You're about to apply a 10 gig image. If the boot image is another 0.1, okay.
Okay, so fine. So even if I'm not going to use PowerShell in my boot image, I want PowerShell to be there. So if I do need to troubleshoot, I don't need to create a VB script. I can just on the fly power up a PowerShell prompt and get the WMI, whatever I need to do, right? So it's just faster. Now, if you have a task sequence, it is the ability to run. If I go to this, I have the ability to actually run a PowerShell script because there's a native function to do this. This is a very useless PowerShell script that just prompts stuff on the screen. But if we open that PowerShell script, which I have here, around somewhere around here, go to
search,
maybe demo PowerShell script, and open that, and make it slightly bigger. You can see that it has a function and has another function to import all the variables and has to start looping, and it's going to write stuff to the screen. If we use write progress activity, that's going to pop up in the task sequence engine, so you can see the commands are actually running if you want to do that. And of course, you can do things like this, just, you know, waiting because you can. Another way to run a PowerShell script is to run it like this. You run it as a command line. So in this case, I have just a sequence that does nothing else than do
That's a
VB script. So it's going to do nothing at all in the end. And then from that command prompt, we can now execute the script. So I'm going to go to that machine. And I'm going to pick this sequence. It's called user dev, here it is. And I'm going to pick that one. I'm going to do next. And I'm going to do begin. So now it's going to run this. It's going to end up with just an empty OK. And that means that the sequence is running. If the sequence is running, I can start PowerShell elevated, and I can load the SMS TS environment. And from within that, I can now play with my variables pretty much like Johan did in VB script. That means it's pretty easy to create your own things like PowerShell wrappers or things like that. The only thing we need to do is this. We need to import that object and put it in something, and now we have the ability to dump that information out. So I'm going to run this. It's elevated. I'm going to paste this in. I'm going to make it slightly bigger. Now we can see the super advanced OK button coming up. And let's remove all this stuff that we don't need to have. Yes, I know. So now we have the ability to load that. And now I can run this to get the variables out of the system. And if I run this one, it can give me everything. So this is the way we start developing script. Can I? Do I have the right? So what's the variable for that? So we're converting every TSM environment variables into a PowerShell variable. And if you go to my blog and you search for something like BIOS upgrade, you want to find one of those PowerShell script that uses this functionality. So it's basically a PowerShell wrapper around it.
All right, slides.
Slides coming up.
So this is very easy in Light Touch to do, what Michael did. It's more tricky in Config Manager. Next slide. But what we can do in Config Manager is we can borrow. I was about to say steal, but we don't do that. We borrow a component from MDT, and we use it together with Config Manager. So next slide, please.
It says demo.
Yes. Very happy that you. So let me start up a client here. It's a Windows 10 machine. And on my site server, I have a sequence created exclusively for debugging scripts. So I just have a very short sequence, use the package, run the gather, and then it's using the service UI component to actually just launch a command prompt. Because that command prompt will now run as system, as the sequence itself allow me to access stuff which you normally do not have access to when you're running a sequence, because it will prevent you from interacting with it unless you are in Windows PE. So if I go to that client, log in. I've already deployed this sequence. I will just open Software Center. And I will run that sequence. Downloading and installing software. It's downloading the MDT package. It runs gather eventually. But in the meantime, I will open up a elevated command prompt, because you can clearly see that the sequence engine is running. If I go to this folder, I'm a local administrator. You can see it in the title bar, but just to make sure, I'm an admin. And if I run a script that tries to access the sequence variables right now, it's not going to be happy. But if I wait until the sequence opens the other command prompt, which is yellow, and I run the exact same script, then I do have the variables. And this allows me to run my scripts over and over, change them, run them, until I nail them. And then I will update them the package and deploy it as normal. But this is saving you so much time when debugging scripts in the sequence engine, because updating packages, having it redistributed, it's just interesting. Slides.
It says GPO refresh and web services.
Yes. Shorthand story here. A common error or issue, especially with light touch deployments, is that you have a policy in your environment that will break the process. But what you very easily can do is you can use web services to move the machines around. So if I get the, thank you. You can download these web services from CodePlex. I've been around for quite some time. I have some of my blogs as well. But in your sequences, you can simply add instructions, in this case to say, hey, in this case, I'm getting the target of you from a database where the machine is supposed to end up eventually. That was stored that away in a variable. Then I will set the staging of you to which I have no grow policies at all. That's what I'm going to use for my entire deployment. But in the very end of the sequence, I simply call the web service that moves that machine by calling a web service that contacts the domain controller and moves the object to the right location, and then I do a final reboot. So now I can run through the entire sequence without any policies applied, but in the end, I'll make sure that the policies I do want to happen on the box is actually on the box. It could be policies that displays a notification. It could be policies that renames local admin. They will really, really break the light touch sequence. But if you do it this way, the problem goes away. Now.
Slides, UEFI deployments. So deploying to UEFI is not a problem itself. It works pretty decent. But you need to shift from BIOS to UEFI. And that is, of course, always the challenging. Now, on your screen right now is a blog post from CCM Exec.
Yes, Jürgen. Mr. Jürgen.
Yes, a nice guy. And it's very generic, which is the good thing. It goes through all the steps you need to do. But the basic idea is very simple. You need to grab the data. You need to store the data. You need to shift. And you need to reboot. And it's going to be like flying on the other side of the moon. So there's going to be a glitch on that.
Check this blog.
And check Mike.
Session from earlier this week.
Yeah, because you did the demo and session on doing the same thing, right? Yeah.
Similar.
Well, using the tool from 1E. But hey, the idea is to change from BIOS to UEFI.
Yeah.
And that is absolutely doable.
Slides, please.
Slides, please.
Yes.
Okay, slides, please. It says demo. It says resources.
Yes.
Yeah, we have books.
On this site, we have gathered links to videos, books, trainings around OWASP deployment, books that we have written, other authors have written as well. Kent is here on the Ignite as well.
Yes.
And there is only one thing left for us to do, and that is to thank you guys for spending the morning with us and have a great, great Ignite. Thank you.
Thank you.